All right, so welcome to this event. Thank you all for coming to this event organized by the LSE International Drug Policy Unit. The public event is called Rethinking the Origins of the Drug War in Mexico. My name is Tanya Harmer, and I'm an associate professor in the Department of International History here at the LSE. I've been asked to mention a couple of logistical things just to begin with. As I think you're aware by now, this event will be podcasted and recorded. So if you don't want to be recorded, I'm going to ask that you don't ask a question in the Q&A, but you can approach, obviously, the speakers after the event if you want to ask a private question. Please make sure your mobile phones are on silent. And if you want to tweet, and tweeting is encouraged, the hashtag is hashtag LSE Mexico Drugs for this event. So we want to thank Professor Peter Trubowitz and Dr. John Collins for supporting this event and making it possible. Charlotte Eaton and Chris Gilson also for helping with the logistics and communication. The International Drugs Policy Unit here at LSE is a cross-regional and multidisciplinary unit that is gracefully hosted by the US Center here at LSE, and it's designed to establish a global center for the study of evidence-based international drug policy by utilizing LSE's academic expertise and its networks, and obviously inviting expertise and experts to the LSE to talk about these issues. This event falls very much under the IDPU remit. And today what we're doing is we're bringing together two historians who are going to be talking about the drug war in Mexico from a historical perspective and very much recontextualizing the interplay between US involvement in that drug war and local actors and the interrelationship between the two, and very much focusing on the origins of what we kind of tend to talk about it as a contemporary phenomenon. So the two speakers today, I will introduce them both now. They're going to speak for about 30 minutes each before question and answer with the audience. And I'm going to introduce them in the order that they're going to speak. So Dr. Carlos Perez Ricard is a postdoctoral fellow in contemporary history and public policy of Mexico at the University of Oxford. He is a member of both the History Department and the Latin America Center at Oxford, and he works on the activities of law enforcement agencies in the United States and the transnational construction of the war on drugs in Mexico between 1938 and 1978. He's recently published on the history of Mexican drug war, and is working on these issues currently. Dr. Benjamin Smith is a reader in Latin American history at the University of Warwick. He is one of the leading historians on the political and cultural history of post-revolutionary Mexico. He has published extensively on religious and popular conservatism, work cultures, and crime and violence in modern Mexico. He's also recently co-edited a book entitled Beyond the Drug War in Mexico, Human Rights, the Public Sphere, and Justice, in which Dr. Perez had a chapter. And his most recent book, which will be published later this year with UNC, is a history of the Mexican press called Stories from the Newsroom, Stories from the Street. So we're very, very delighted to have both speakers here with us tonight. As I said, they're both going to speak for 30 minutes, and then we'll open up to Q&A. So, Dr. Perez, do you want to
start?
Thank
you. Thank you so much.
Hola.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay, also, for the invitation. It's great to be here. The intention of this talk today is to provide you with a general overview of the history and origins of the Mexican war on drugs. This is a rather challenging task to achieve in just 30 minutes, but I will try my best. Since I know that many of you, or I imagine that many of you, are not familiar with the history of the drug trade and drug policies, I will present some basic facts that may come as something new for many of you. After that, I will present three arguments on three different dimensions of drug policy, which may help us to rethink the origins of the Mexican war on drugs. This was the task for today. The first one, the first argument, relates to the very origins of the Mexican war on drugs. I will try to explain that the war on drugs in Mexico began long before you thought. What is more, in some periods of the 20th century, it was more militarized and punitive than is today. The second argument is about the state-crime relations in Mexico throughout the 20th century. I will develop the argument that the emergence and evolution of illicit drug market was encouraged by the state. However, I will try to show how the state-illicit drug economy relations are much more complex than generally believed. Finally, I'm going to touch on the topic of the US-Mexican relations regarding drug policy. Unlike most of the bibliography, I will argue that even if it is true that the US shaped Mexican drug policy, I will try to stress that the US government did not impose it, didn't impose drug policy in Mexico. This is a conclusion I was able to reach after examining recently the classified archives and being for some years in Washington and in Berlin through my doctoral research. So, what do we talk about when we talk about the drug war in Mexico? The war on drugs, I will define the war on drugs as the implementation of a set of policies characterized by their punitive and militarized dimension, whose final goal is to end the economic chain which joins the point of production with those of drug consumption. This will be the definition I will be using for the rest of my talk. This strategy has its historical roots in the beginning of the 20th century and was institutionalized as state policy in the early decades of that century, the 20th century. For many of you, this may be unexpected. We normally relate the idea of the Mexican war on drugs to the decision of Felipe Calderón to send more than 6,000 Mexican soldiers to the state of Michoacán to end drug violence there in 2006. For others, more familiar with the US bibliography on drugs, the idea of war on drugs is linked with the strategy announced by Richard Nixon to combat drugs in the early 70s and, of course, with the creation of the DEA in 1973. Well, the history of drug policy, and more concretely, the history of a set of policies characterized by their punitive and militarized dimension is much more older than that. As a matter of fact, we have traced the concept of the war of the war on drugs to a publication in the Washington Post in July 1910. The acknowledgement of a pre-history of the war on drugs before Nixon and Calderón is a matter of bibliographical consensus in the topic, as you can see here. Nevertheless, this continues to surprise the public and journalists who tend to think that everything that happens in our contemporary world is recent. Well, the job of scholars is to show that some seemingly new social processes have in fact been around for quite a while. In this particular case, for this occasion, my intention is to discuss the existence of the war on drugs decades before Felipe Calderón announced his campaign in December 2006, and even long before Richard Nixon did the same in 1973. Having said that, let me introduce the three different ideas to you that will shape this attempt to give an overview of the Mexican war on drugs. The first one, as I said, is the next statement. The war on drugs in Mexico began long before you thought. What is more, in some periods of the 20th century, it was more militarized and punitive than today. The second one, again, the drug trade was encouraged by the states. However, the state illicit drug economy relations are much more complex than we generally believed. And the third point, the US shaped Mexican drug policy but didn't impose it. So I will begin with the first argument. Let me start introducing you the war on drugs in Mexico through three different lenses. The first one, the enactment of prohibitionist laws. The second one, the launch of eradication campaigns. And the third one, the politics of addict criminalization in Mexico. As you can see here in this slide, most of the first federal anti-drug laws in Mexico were enacted between 1911 and 1920. I find very interesting that most of these laws were enacted in the toughest years of the Mexican Revolution, in which no law at all could be enforced by the federal government. As you may know, the revolution started in 1910, and it was not until 1920 that a stable government was established, or really established in Mexico. So the question arises, why were all these laws enacted precisely in such a difficult period? There are at least two different explanations for that. The first one is the xenophobia against the Chinese community in Mexico and the fear that they may infect Mexicans with their vice. I will go deeper into that in a few minutes. But the second argument is the idea that the Mexican race could be harmed by drugs. In particular, the Carrancista faction, a very important faction during the revolution, had a very moralist approach on drugs. This moralist approach can be traced with accuracy throughout the 1970 constitutional debates. Some Carrancista governors of that time not only prohibited drugs, but also music, dance, and alcohol. This was, for example, the case of Pablo González in Matamoros in 1916. As new research has shown, the US, the United States, didn't play an important or a significant role in the enactment of these laws, of these policies. It is true that some conservative groups compelled the US government in some way to pressure the Mexican government to apply a prohibitionist position towards drugs. However, I believe that there is some bibliographical consensus now that this was rather insignificant. The second key element of drug policy in Mexico has been the launch of eradication campaigns. These are, or we can define eradication campaigns as a set of operations that consisted in sending delegations of sanitary, state, and federal police officers, as well as military forces, to the mountains of Sinaloa, Durango, and Chihuahua, what we called the Triangulo Dorado, or Golden Triangle. Which historically centers, these are historically centers of opium supply in Mexico. These delegations of police and military had the purpose of destroying the poppy fields in the region. Records of eradication campaign exist from as early as 1938. With modern technology and airplanes, the practice of sending delegations to the mountains still exists in 2018. We know now that these campaigns were launched as a result of both. First, the interest of the federal government, of the late 30s, to control the enrichment of local elites in that region, and in a less extent, very less extent, the pressure of the United States, in particular the U.S. Customs Office, to reduce the offer of Mexican opium. These campaigns were paid by the Mexican government, but were accompanied and only in some way coordinated by US officials in Mexico. We also know that US customs officials maintained cash funds from which they paid informants and some of the servicemen extra expenses, including entertainment and travel allowances. But the important thing here is it was the Mexican government that paid for the eradication campaigns. The central government, and this would be my argument for this point, was genuinely concerned with the illegal sowing of opium and with the enrichment of a local elite in that region. One can argue that in that particular moment of contemporary history, one of state building, of real estate building, the central government was trying to enforce compliance with the new laws, cementing their still fragile authority. During this specific moment of state centralization or efforts for state centralizations, the objectives of the federal government were to enforce policies among all realms of society and not merely the subaltern members of it. So, Even if the US variable was important in the developing of the campaigns, I think it is fair to say that this state policy would have happened even in the absence of any pressure of the United States. A third element that helped us to examine the origins of the Mexican war on drugs is the criminalization of the addicts, an area that definitely needs further research, not only in Mexico, but in Latin America as well. Traditional consumption of plants and mushrooms by the indigenous communities has always been stigmatized by society in Mexico. As a matter of fact, as I'm showing you here, peyote was banned in Mexico by the Santa Inquisition since 1620. It is false to assume that recreational consumption of psychoactive substances has been causal or a traditional part of the majority of Mexican society. I mentioned this a few minutes ago, but I want to come back to it for a second. The criminalization of the addict is heavily related to the racism against the opium-smoking Chinese community in Mexico. This xenophobia determined much of the beginning of the social rejections against the opium consumption of opium. This is actually a work done by Isaac Campos Costero that analyzed a lot of newspapers of the early 1920s and 1930s. When analyzing newspapers of that period, it is common to find allusions to the Chinese as, I'm quoting here for the podcast, vicious people who corrupted our tradition, or as people who have become degenerate because of the delusionary effects produced by opium. In general, this is no more the quote, in general, it is safe to assume that this stigmatization led to punitive policies against addicts in Mexico throughout the whole 20th century. As a matter of fact, during most of the century, Mexican drug addicts lived in a sort of judicial limbo. For entire decades, they were given the status of temibilidad predelictiva, pre-crime danger, a juristic concept outside, completely outside, the constitutional framework which guaranteed the criminalization of the addicts for years. Furthermore, until its reform in 1968, the Código Penal de la Federación, the Federal Code, did not distinguish at all between individuals who were trafficking drugs, possessing drugs without using them, or possessing drugs and using them. No distinction at all. What is more, during the 1940s, Mexican officials adopted a series of increasingly punitive drug regulations. The majority of these measures were implicitly or explicitly endorsed by the United States, but not imposed directly by them. Perhaps the best example to show this is the 1945 decree, which suspended the individual rights of addicts and drug trafficking and drug traffickers in Mexico. The decree permitted alleged drug dealers and addicts to be sent to federal prison on the Islas Marias in Mexico without trial or any other judicial processes. The islands were not only the destinations for drug dealers, but all kinds of addicts which were considered best, I'm quoting again, segregated from society for some time to cure them from entrenched vices or harmful customs. By the mid-1950s, the Mexican Federal Crime Code was much more oppressive in regard to drugs than the law applied in the United States. Contrary to what some experts had claimed, Mexico didn't Americanize its penal code. As a matter of fact, the Mexican Penal Code was used as a model for the enactment of the 1951 Box Act and the 1956 Narcotics Control Act, two of the cornerstone of drug prohibitionism in the US. In summary, addict segregation has been part of Mexican history since the early 20th century. It is nothing new. A reform to current drug policy in Mexico should begin in recognizing the failure of the criminalization to the addict throughout the 20th century. I think that's fair to say. This is my second argument for today. The emergence and evolution of the illicit drug market in Mexico cannot be understood without the active participation of the Mexican state. This is a no-brainer, right? However, I would like to point out some nuances to this statement. Even if there are plenty of works that identify the participation of some institutions in the emergence and evolution of the illicit drug market in Mexico throughout the 20th century, my impression is that we still lack an historical comprehensive account of state-crime relations in Mexico. Well, Ben Smith here is writing a book on that at the moment, and he will tell us in a few years the answer for that. So in the light of the absence of that book and of extensive scholarship in this regard, let me present an hypothesis which relates to the broader topic of this presentation and which we can discuss, if you want, in the answer and questions session. So even if we should acknowledge the fact that the Mexican state did participate in the emergence and rise of the illicit drug economy, that doesn't mean that Mexico experienced, as many have said, a centrally regulated illicit market throughout the 20th century. What is more, not even in the peak of its power, the pre-government enjoyed the capacity to regulate the illicit market completely. For most of the 20th century, a race between different circuits of power and institutions to dominate this illegal market took place. In the shadow of this ongoing power struggle, the drug trade flourished. During the first years, 1920s, 1930s, when the market was concentrated in northern Mexico, state governors, municipal presidents, military and civilian authorities fought for the control of a small but important market. The creation of the Dirección Federal de Seguridad in 1947 and the transfer of responsibilities over drug policy from the Ministry of Health to the Office of the State Attorney General, the PGR, did not, as many have argued, led to a, I'm quoting Monica Serrano now, a stage for a state-led model of regulation built around a number of agreements binding state agencies and criminal entrepreneurs. I don't believe this thesis. The idea of a period between 1947 and 1985 in which state crime relations were sustained by many unspoken roles and in which the logic of political power preceded over the criminal market, I think, is false. As recent bibliography has shown, the Mexican state was not as powerful, as strong, as we tend to believe. My hypothesis here is that drug trafficking remained organized locally in a very similar way like today and was the result of continuing struggles between particular criminal circuits in which state and non-state actors cohabitated. Under these conditions of fragmentation of interest, the execution of drug policies remained incomplete and always divided. The third part of this presentation relates to the influence of the U.S. in Mexico. The argument is twofold. The first one, as stated before, by the late 30s in Mexico, the negative representations of drug use as well as punitive practices were well established in Mexico. However, during the 1940s, the U.S., in particular their drug agencies, deployed a series of pressuring mechanisms which shaped drug policy in Mexico. The second part of the argument would be the next one, the following. Even if the U.S. did use coercive methods on some occasion to pressure the Mexican government, most of the times, and in most of the conjunctures, the law enforcement agency's tactics to shape Mexican drug policies relied heavily on persuasion. It was a matter of persuasion and not of coercion. It was mainly through these methods that the U.S. reached its goals, with three exceptions. Unlike what happened afterwards and before, in the 1940s, the U.S. did use some coercive methods to oblige Mexico to follow specific policies on specific occasions. The best known moment of this is when Harry Anslinger, chief of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, detained in 1940 all shipments of medical supply to Mexico in order to stop a public health-oriented opium maintenance program for drug addicts. That program, developed by a well-known physician, Leopoldo Salazar Viniegra, opened the door to the creation of state clinics authorized by the states to supply the substances required by the addicts at a low price. In the spring of 1940, the first of those clinics opened in Mexico City with positive results. However, this experiment reached its end in the summer of 1940 due to an embargo on all shipments of medical supply to Mexico. These are quotes that I managed to read from the Anslinger archives, in which he is very happy about the fact that no medical supply is coming to Mexico. As head of U.S. drug control, Anslinger could determine whether or not other countries were complying with international drug regulations. So he did this embargo. Similarly, in 1947, Harry Anslinger used his position as delegate of the newly created Commission on Narcotic Drugs for pressuring Mexico to adopt radical measures against drug trafficking. He exposed the failures of Mexican authorities in stopping the increase of Mexican opium of the US. What is more, he threatened the Mexican government with similar measures as in 1940 and with uncovering alleged relations between close friends of the Mexican president and drug traffickers. The reaction in that particular conjuncture, 1947, the reaction of the Mexican government was to expand the eradication campaign in the Mexican Golden Triangle, to judicialize drug control efforts, and to reform the Federal Crime Code by increasing fines and prison sentences. A third episode took place when President Nixon surprisingly decided to close the border with Mexico in 1969, an operation known as Operation Intercept. But I think you will talk something on that, so I will not speak on that. These three moments, these three episodes, in particular the first two, took place in very specific conjunctures and at a time in which the political field of drug policy was little developed. However, historians and political scientists have read these episodes, these three episodes, as examples of how the Mexican-US bilateral relationship used to work in the field of drug policy. Naturally, these episodes were crucial in showing the Mexican government the limitations of its autonomy in drug policy. However, as mentioned before, this is the hypothesis, these incidents, these three incidents, were not the rule, but the exception. For the rest of the century, the US used persuasive methods to influence the Mexican drug policy. The best way to shape Mexican policy was by cultivating relationships with a very small group of Mexican officials that eventually ascended to power positions inside the federal police, the Attorney General Office in Mexico, and the Foreign Ministry, often due to the support they received by the US. In the following, I will present only one example of this. Manuel Rosales Miranda was a minor official of the PGR, of the Attorney General, when George White, Anslinger's top field manager, visited Mexico City in 1949. This guy, this Rosales Miranda, was given the task to drive and accompany him. This seemingly tribal function served as the stepping stone for Rosales Miranda, who remained a key contact for White and the Federal Bureau of Narcotics in Mexico. In 1958, for example, Rosales Miranda oversaw the negotiation with the U.S. Treasury Department for the participation of Mexican agents in a training school with the purpose of offering the Mexican, I'm quoting here, full training in narcotic enforcement with general and technical instruction on a practical or practicable basis covering the detection and prevention of drug trafficking. Rosales Miranda, and this is again only one case of many, also played a key role in the bilateral meeting in 1965 discussing a new narcotics agenda. In the early 1970s, when Rosales Miranda assumed his position as Deputy Attorney General from 1973 to 1982, for 9 years, he was appointed to direct the negotiation with the DEA officers to draw the limits of the activities of DEA agents on Mexican soil. He also assumed the commitment to persuade Luis Echeverría Álvarez, former president of Mexico, of the benefits, of the alleged benefits, of the air eradication program and the Compass Trip project developed by the NASA and the DEA in the late 70s. Rosales Miranda illustrates here the case of many other police officers, attorney generals, and diplomats who were promoted and sometimes protected for many years by U.S.-American law enforcement agencies. In some instances, their ties to the U.S.-American agencies were closer than to the Mexican government they officially worked for. What I want to stress here is the existence and success of trans-government relations through which the U.S. could advance its interests. Naturally, those coalitions, these transgovernmental coalitions, have to be continually negotiated and were jeopardized by decisions taken by the central government, for instance, during Operation Intercept in 1969. However, as Rosales Miranda case illustrates, the network remained stable even during the most trying events and episodes. I'm concluding now. Over the last 30 minutes or so, I have tried to provide you with a general overview of the history and origins of the Mexican war on drugs, presenting some basic facts like the attitude toward the Chinese and indigenous communities, the harsh punitive measures taken against addicts, which serve as a model for the US, then in turn the liberalization and forward-thinking programs to integrate addicts into society, which were crushed by Anslinger, and last but not least, the close ties between Mexican and U.S.-American officials which shaped Mexican drug policy. These are, of course, only preliminary conclusions based on the information available until now. I am sure that the complete history of the Mexican war on drugs remains to be written. Thank you.
Right, and you can now see the difference between myself and Carlos, and the difference that 10 years make. My PowerPoint is much worse than yours. Right, okay, so I think as Tania said, this is part of a broader project that has been promised to the AHLC next year, hence probably won't be done by next year, which is a broadly entitled a kind of history of the Mexican drug trade from 1910 to 1989. So I'm quite happy to answer other questions. I might not know the answers to them, but I'm happy to at least field other questions about more broadly about the trade and the history of the trade in Mexico. Today, however, I'm going to be talking about, I think, one of the kind of key turning points in the war on drugs, and the argument being that many of the strategies and the ideas that underlay Nixon's kind of war on drugs in the late 1960s, early 1970s, emerged in California in the preceding decade, in the decade of the 1950s. And they emerged not necessarily as kind of top-down political ideas, but they emerged among members of civil society, and, somewhat strangely, they were echoed by members of civil society on the other side of the border, particularly in the state of Baja California Norte, which I'm going to be talking about as well. Okay, so I'm going to start with a quick anecdote then. On August the 6th, 1956, the U.S. consul in Tijuana reported on the local reaction to a recent interview by the San Diego district attorney. During the interview, the district attorney not only blamed Mexico for America's drug problems, but also cast doubt on the Mexican authorities' willingness to control drug traffic. He argued the solution was the prohibition of U.S. youths from entering Mexico, and if necessary, the temporary closure of the border. Only such a drastic measure, he claimed, would force the Mexican authorities to take note. As the consul explained, national politicians in Mexico completely ignored the slight. They didn't even put out a press release denying it. They didn't have to. But local politicians in Baja California could not. The pre-governor of the state, somebody called Braulio Maldonado Sandez, was already under pressure. On both sides of the border, people were accusing Maldonado of ordering the murder of the crusading Tijuana journalist Manuel Acosta Meza just 2 weeks earlier. The combination then of factors compelled the governor to act. And during the first week of August, just after these district attorney allegations, he sacked the city police chief, he announced he was going to move the seat of government from Mexicali to Tijuana, and he ordered an immediate clean-up of what he called the vice, the official bribery, and other conditions reflecting adversely on Tijuana. So this talk, then, examines California's 1950s moral panic over drug use and its consequences in the bordering Mexican state of Baja California Norte. As the consul suggested then, the 1950s drug panic in California worked at two levels. In California, both politicians and members of civil society developed a distinct set of arguments on how to stop the drug trade. They blamed US drug use on Mexico. They targeted the problem of Mexican corruption, which they saw as the key link. And they suggested that manipulation of border traffic was a crucial way to blackmail the Mexican authorities to crack down on traffickers. Now, by the late 1960s, these arguments had become cornerstones of US and particularly Republican national counter-narcotics policy. And in actual fact, in 1969, President Nixon even implemented the de facto shutting of the border in the form of Operation Intercept. So these ideas that have been percolating around kind of right-wing groups in California in the 1950s were what Nixon then introduces in 1969, in basically this de facto shutting of the border. But California's moral panic not only formed the basis for Nixon's war on drugs, it also had serious contemporary effects south of the border. Here, a kind of complex interplay of exogenous and endogenous pressures emerged. Californian denouncements of Baja California's corruption interwove with and strengthened homegrown Mexican hostility to the ruling pre-party. Such pressure, when combined with US pressure, often forced the local authorities to act. And act they did, enacting periodic, well-publicised crackdowns on narcotics traffickers, corrupt cops, and mostly low-level addicts. Now, by examining these dynamics and effects of California's 1950s moral panic, the talk brings together two distinct historiographies. The first is the historiography of the US's own war on drugs. And so there's a lot of debate over the kind of origins and rhythms. Most people now see the 1950s as a key decisive point of inflection on the US war on drugs. During this decade, politicians, bureaucrats, members of civil society not only established a new and radically more punitive judicial framework, but also developed a distinct narrative, or what they call cultural script, underlying basically to justify these legal changes. This narrative, according to US scholars, contains two elements. One, the African-American or Mexican-American pusher, and two, the white, often female, drug user or victim. I'd like to argue there's a third element to this, and that was the Mexican drug trafficker. This narrative, I would argue, that of the Mexican drug trafficker, underlay a series of suggested approaches to drug use, which emerged in the 1950s and then were implemented during the late 60s and early 70s. The second historiography that this is based on is research on Mexico's own drug war. Now, early estimations, as Carlos made clear, highlighted the US's pervasive influence. Recently, a handful of scholars have started to reframe and nuance this tale of diplomatic dependency. Some have stressed Mexico's own homegrown counter-narcotics rhetoric, which rested on prejudices against indigenous groups, female healers, Chinese immigrants. Others have argued that exterior pressures may have inspired more aggressive policies, but they were shaped and implemented according to much more pressing domestic logics of institution building, state formation, or the repression of rural revolts. I would like to extend these conclusions down to the subnational level. US policy shaped efforts to the south, yet even here domestic politics played a decisive role. In Baja California Norte, civil society organizations, newspapers, opposition politicians fed, read, rejigged and redeployed US denouncements in order to press for their own brand of political change. To survive, local pre-politicians had to act, firing corrupt cops, arresting major drug traffickers, and operating periodic moralisation and clean-up campaigns. To extend then a fairly tired metaphor, it was not so much the US sneezed and Mexico caught a cold, but rather the US sneezed, some Mexicans pretended to catch a cold, then used that cold to get off work, annoy the boss, and feign some sort of common affliction with their hypochondriac neighbour. You'll follow that throughout the talk. During the 1950s then, a series of moral panics over the Mexican production of heroin and marijuana beset Californian politics. Now, these had a long history, these kind of moral panics. From the 1910s onwards, Californians had developed a distinct black legend of border permissiveness, which focused on the allure of Chinese opium dens, horse racing, prostitution, and then by the 20s, cheap alcohol. Now, like previous scares, the 1950s drug panic was rooted in the print media. Starting in the 1950s then, borderland newspapers like the San Diego Union and many others ran an increasing number of stories on drug use, drug peddling and drug trafficking. We can now quantitatively analyse these. So, for example, from 1940 to 1950, the San Diego Union published 1,600 articles on narcotics. The following decade, that is the decade of the 50s, it published triple that amount. And over 30% of all the articles that it published, that is 1,700 articles, made direct reference to Mexico. A quarter of all the articles referenced Tijuana. Now, to establish the link between drug use and Mexico, newspapers used a variety of approaches, sensationalist news stories, campaigning editorials, and also investigative reports. Now, these investigative reports were particularly strong. In 1952, the San Diego Union published a series of explosive articles by a journalist called Gene Fusion, who posed as a drug addict to buy narcotics in Tijuana. Here he explained how, you're going to have to try and understand 1950s jive talk here, he explained how hypes, that is heroin addicts and weed heads, taught him the street lingo, which was a mixture of gangsterese and jive talk, the mannerisms of a head, and how to walk with the peculiar shuffle of a pachuco. After picking up some ticks, he visited Junkie Alley, where he tried to purchase some H, heroin, but was only offered, disappointingly, secas, or marijuana. He went to an underground bar where teenagers drunk and smoked, or, as he claimed it, lushed for a double kick. A sailor made love in a back room, and a bathroom attendant sold pornography. At first, he admitted it, business was rotten, the atmosphere matched it, but by 2 a.m, teenagers started to appear. Within an hour, the place was full, a five-piece jazz band had started to play, the bar had transformed into a shouting, struggling, jitterbugging mass of humanity. The dancing was, according to the journalist, fueled entirely by marijuana, which was sold by the Duchess, a cadaverous man with acne scars and bushy hair, from the back of a closely guarded booth. So outside then print journalism, the mass media's depiction of the links between drug use and Mexico was slightly more muted. Federal control of film and TV was much more developed than it was of the press, and particularly Harry Anslinger and the FBN disapproved of on-screen portrayals of drug use. At least one TV documentary on the easy purchase of drugs in Tijuana was dropped at the last minute because of the good neighbour policy. So there was a degree of kind of control. However, gradually, a range of different genres started to investigate the border drug trade. And by the late 1950s, you've got things like Tijuana Story, which is an extraordinary, still banned in Mexico. It's an extraordinary tale, basically about the murder of this crusading journalist, Mesa da Costa, that I'll speak about later. You also got slightly more trashy xenophobic teen exploitation flicks, like 18 and Anxious, The Young Captives, as well as subtly, more kind of subtly subversive movies like Touch of Evil. By the late 1950s, TV stations had also started to show depictions of the trade. In November 1959, KRCA showed three telecasts entitled Heroin, about the problem of narcotics in Mexico and California. In the most explosive episode, an undercover reporter purchased heroin on a Tijuana street and interviewed a former Mexican cop who explained the ways the authorities protected the trade. The media's then focus on border trafficking resonated with two crucial groups that I think promoted this border panic. The first were moralising civil society organisations. They included women's organisations like the General Federation of Women's Clubs and the Women's Civic League, business organisations like the Rotary Club, the Lions, various chambers of commerce, parents' groups, school boards and veterans' associations. The second group that it appealed to were low-level elected officials from border communities. These comprised law enforcement officials, sheriffs, for example, school board heads like Richard Barber of San Diego, who declared Tijuana probably the most sinful city in the Western world, judicial appointees like the Superior Court judge, we can see here, Hanging John Huaker, a.k.a. Blood John, who laughed uproariously as he retired and his fellow judges presented him with a model guillotine. He claimed he was laughing because it matched his miniature noose that he kept in his office. These figures then realised that election depended on a hardline law and order stance. The easiest target was Mexico. In 1952, the mayor of Tijuana, Riley, observed that, and I quote, "Every time there are elections in San Diego, most of the candidates try to use the city of Tijuana and the charges of drug smuggling for campaign material in their favour." Now, during the 1950s, then, California's anti-narcotics crusaders stressed four essential claims. One, they claimed the principal reason for Californian drug use was the state's proximity to the Mexican border. And they continually repeated this rather unsubstantiated claim that all the marijuana and 50 to 75% of the heroin in California came from Mexico. Second, these activists started to focus their fears on a kind of carefully created image of the border kingpin. Now, candidates to play the role of kind of enemy number one were numerous. Contrary to Californian assertions, drug trafficking in northern Mexico was actually relatively horizontal and organised by at least a dozen small family-run operations. But during the 1955 Senate hearings about juvenile delinquency, Californian politicians settled on the figure of a guy called Miguel Big Mike Barragan Bautista. During the hearings, Big Mike dominated proceedings. Heroin addicts testified that they often bought their personal supplies at Big Mike's four-room residence in Colonia Independencia. One said, "If Mike deals with you, no one nabs you at the border." And such influence, apparently, had bought this trafficker, and I quote, "a ranch, racing dogs, the largest house of ill repute in Tijuana, where his wife was a madame and also the principal heroin dealer, and also a taxi rank." Now, over the decade, Big Mike would reappear regularly, kind of haunt the pages of the California dailies as this kind of image of the borderland drug kingpin. Third, California's anti-narcotics moralizers concluded the principal reason for the availability of narcotics was not U.S. demand, like you might think, but rather Mexican corruption. Fusion, for example, suggested that the Mexican government needed to pay more than lip service to the narcotics laws. Summarising this kind of thinking quite succinctly, a follow-up editorial in the LA Times concluded, "There is no reason why northern good living should not overflow the frontier. No reason except the tolerance on the southern side of the most inhuman of human indecencies." Strong language. Fourth, then, the Californian authorities viewed the solution to these problems as the manipulation of the US-Mexican border traffic. Now, initially, this measure was preventative. Officials proposed cutting youth drug use by closing the border to young American tourists. So, for example, in 1952, the San Diego sheriff took matters into his own hands and ran a series of police blockades to check on young tourists crossing the border. Yet, these sporadic border slowdowns also had another effect. They basically blocked traffic for miles. In Tijuana in early 1952, then, when they blocked these youths coming in and created these massive tailbacks, tourism declined markedly in Tijuana. Attendance at, for example, the Sunday horse races dropped by about 50%. As the US consul observed, Mexicans considered the move as the equivalent of closing the border. These effects south of the border then turn the strategy from a kind of stopgap preventative measure into a means to force Mexican officials to clamp down on the border drug trade. Prevention, essentially, turned to extortion. Again, journalists push the move. So Fusion, who continually voices these ideas in the most entertaining way possible, claimed at the Senate subcommittee meeting, if a gate were slammed tomorrow morning and somebody said that we'd only open it when the narcotics business was stopped, you would not find a narcotics peddler within 400 miles of that border by Sunday morning. By the end of the decade, this kind of thinking had become a complete tenet of law and order thinking. So the LA police chief, Chief Parker, said, all you have to do is close the border. They, that is the Mexicans, will come round. They need the money. If that's the only way you can get anything done, maybe it's the only solution. If then, sorry, I'm just going to, from the current side. Right, okay. Right. Next, and much more briefly, Baja California Norte politics and the Mexican reaction. Now, if the Californian moralizers of the 50s started to develop many of the ideas that would become tenets of Republican thinking over the next two decades, the panic also had more immediate effects south of the border. While the Mexican federal government could repeatedly deny Californian accusations, the state authorities in Baja California Norte were in a much more vulnerable position. On the one hand, the governor and the ruling party, this is the governor here on the right-hand side, this guy Braulio Maldonado, that's the president, Ruiz Cortines, the kind of 1950s. The pre-party, the ruling party in Baja California Norte, was pretty weak. Baja California Norte had only become an official federal state in 1953, and the architecture of the ruling party was still under construction. Even Braulio Maldonado admitted that his administration was harmoniously structured chaos. The traditional supports then, like the peasant federations and the workers' unions, were small, underpowered, or close to the Communist Party. The popular sector, which was designed to bring together kind of urban middle-class voters, barely existed. Finally, official control of the print media was extremely fragile. In 1959, one witness claimed the PRI only controlled two newspapers in the whole state. These only printed 500 copies between them. Most of them were openly burned by opposition supporters. Those that were not were bought in bulk, defaced with the initials of the opposing party, the PAN, and repurposed as anti-PRI propaganda. So the PRI then had very little control. In contrast, opposition to the ruling party was relatively strong. Tijuana, in particular, but also in Mexicali to a certain extent, contained a raft of independent civil society organizations, from the Chamber of Commerce among the elites to cross-class single-issue organizations like tax pressure groups to mutual aid societies, which dominated the kind of poorer barrios of Tijuana. Now, these civil society groups were kept informed by a vibrant and popular public sphere. Rapid immigration, a relatively literate population, the proximity of a US market and cheap printing presses created a rapid upsurge in newspapers in Baja California. And most of these were extremely critical of the press. Perhaps the most famous then was that of a guy called Manuel Acosta Meza, who published a newspaper called El Imparcial. The newspaper was extremely critical of the pre-government, and particularly of Braulio Maldonado, who he claimed openly abetted local drug traffickers, gangsters, and other criminals. In 1956, Acosta Meza even threatened to publish a full list of all the public administrators who were taking money from the owners of illegal brothels, or what he termed the Union of Pimps. This accusation, or this threat, probably got Acosta Meza killed in 1956. But despite the death of Acosta Meza, others continued to kind of, others took his place, including his former colleague, this chap, Carlos Ortega, which you can see here, can't quite see on the top of his typewriter, he's holding a gun because he claims he's under threat. He not only published this list of the Union of Pimps, but also wrote a book about the events leading up to Acosta's murder, provocatively entitled Tijuana la Ciudad Maldita, or Tijuana the Damned City, which was engraved with a picture of a vampire bat, as you can see, a prostitute and a hypodermic needle. They also included among the journalists a guy called José Garduño Bustamante, who was consistently critical of Maldonado's government in his newspaper, The Noticias. He apparently always kept an eye on the window to avoid an attack on his life. And he was framed at least twice for narcotics trafficking. He got off twice because he claimed he was too fat to put the marijuana under his car. That's what he claimed to the US customs officials. In fact, he was so sure he was being framed for drug trafficking that he ran an aviso on the front page of his newspaper which said, if I am caught for drug trafficking, it is because I am being framed by the local police chief. He was fairly sure that this was going on. Okay, so Baja California Norte's opposition groups both nourished and amplified California's own moral panic. Now, in part, this was politics. What better way to attack a political opponent than to feed the criticisms of a supposedly neutral neighbour? However, it also reflected a kind of deep-seated discomfort with Tijuana's international reputation as this kind of house of sin. As early as 1951, the US consul admitted that the city had a very substantial element, supported and represented by the Mexican official family and civic groups, that was alive to the situation of youth drug taking and was anxious to bring around corrective measures. And this they did. They fed rumours and they fed information about corruption to the newspapers in California. They also, when accusations were brought by the Californian press or by Californian lawmakers against Baja California, then the Baja California journalists and civil society organisations reprinted it. So there's a continual interplay between civil society in California and Baja California, but for very different reasons. Now, with the support of the federal government and certain high-profile figures in the US, the state administration of Baja California, that is Braulio Maldonado, could have rode out either the California denunciations or the internal Baja California pressure. But the combination was too much. And in order basically to save his government, Braulio Maldonado and his successors were forced to repeatedly enact periodic public crackdowns on the drug trade. Most of the time, these were mass, what were called razzias or raids, which picked up dozens of basically low-level drug addicts. So, for example, in September 1957, 2 days after Judge Huica, that's Blood John, challenged the U.S. ambassador in Mexico City to visit Tijuana and followed it up with one of his demands to shut the border, the Baja California Norte police made 83 arrests of crooks and vagrants linked to the drug trade throughout the city. The following year, there was an exact replay. On the 15th of August, 1958, Huica urged the federal government to shut the border. 2 days later, the Tijuana government imposed a curfew on under-18s and arrested 79 youths who had broken that new law. Now, these kind of mass raids, as a response, had the advantage of mass arrests and also bulk seizures, which the government now publicly burned drugs meters from the California border. I presume that the moralizers probably smell the smoke from there. But when the pressure was really on, the state authorities also went after some of the more significant traffickers. So, for example, in the wake of the Acosta Meza killing, Tijuana police arrested Dominga Urias Iriarte, a.k.a. La Minga, who was the major broker between the Sinaloa opium growers and the border heroin sellers. They also raided Mike Barragan's ranch. They arrested a handful of other major traffickers in conjunction with the FBN. So these California pressures, when combined with Baja California pressures, forced the pre-government to act. In conclusion then, During the 1950s, California experienced a kind of moral panic over youth drug use. Politicians, journalists, civil society representatives focused on the threat of drug trafficking over the border and drug use in Tijuana. During this moral panic, they built on and developed various narratives, including those that stressed Mexican corruption and the protection of certain frontier kingpins. They also advanced the strategy of using the temporary closure of the border to force the Mexican authorities into action. By the early 1960s, these views had reached Washington, D.C. In actual fact, Vice President Nixon was writing to the Los Angeles Times to promise that the government would press for, and I quote, a concerted effort on the part of the Mexican government officials. 9 years later, he fulfilled his promise by implementing Operation Intercept, a rigorous stop-and-search campaign on the US border. Like these early slowdowns implemented by local sheriffs, the operation was portrayed as a preventative strategy designed to halt drug imports into the US. Yet, just like these early ad hoc closures, it was actually functioned as a means of extortion. Perhaps this is best summed up by an FBI agent at the time who said, "For diplomatic reasons, the true purpose of the exercise was never revealed. It was an exercise in international extortion, pure and simple and effective, designed to bend Mexico to our will. We figured Mexico could hold out for a month. In fact, they caved in after 2 weeks and we got what we wanted. Operation Intercept gave way to Operation Cooperation." California's moral panic, though, had also profound effect over the border. The Baja California Norte government was forced to impose a series of counter-narcotics measures, including periodic mass arrests, drug seizures, and the sacking of police officials. Yet, these measures were not simply reactions to exogenous US pressure. They were also responses to endogenous demands from members of Mexican civil society to clean up local politics. To put it another way, Mexican drug policy was often determined by subnational politics. In actual fact, from the 40s onwards, other waves of anti-drug measures were as dependent on regional political frameworks as federal mandates or US coercion. So, for example, in 1947 in Tamaulipas, in 1965 in Sinaloa, in 1976 in Sonora, intra-pre-factionalism broke down agreements between traffickers and political elites, what Carlos was talking about, triggered accusations in the public sphere, just like in Baja California, and generated a series of very public counter-narcotics measures. On other occasions, as in Tijuana, the combination of civil society movements and opposition parties, particularly the PAN, forced local governments to act and crack down on drug trafficking. Right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much to both our speakers, to two fascinating presentations. So I'm going to open up now to questions from the audience. We have a microphone as well, so if you have a question, if you could wait for the microphone to come, and if you could introduce yourself before you answer the question, that would be wonderful. One down here.
Dudley Anderson.
Sorry, we have to wait for the microphone.
Dudley Anderson. I just wondered what the two panelists thought the... about the limitations of the American use of Mexican officials to promote their influence in the country. And as an example, the Zorrilla case and Camarena case, where they backed very, in every sense possible, Zorrilla, and then he let them down through the murder of Camarena. And he was their man. And are there other examples of this? I mean, to what extent has this been a successful policy, and to what extent has it backfired?
Thank you.
Do you want to go first? Yes, I suspect we might have slightly differing opinions on this. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The DFS is the kind of classic example where the US backs it through thick and thin throughout these accusations. I mean, most classically, a guy called Nazar Haro, who's the head of the DFS in the early 80s, he gets busted not for drug trafficking, but for... they track a load of stolen cars from San Diego, and they track them all the way down to the DFS car park, And the bloke looks around and finds out the entire DFS basically is driving San Diego license plate Mercedes and BMWs. And basically, the American authorities just don't refuse to move on it. And 4 years later, they find out they're also involved in the drug trafficking business. I think the real break, however, is not with the DFS, but actually with the judicial police around 1976. When López Portillo comes to power in 1976, he massively expands the judicial police under the PGR, and he puts in place a guy called Raul Mendiolea, who becomes head of the judicial police. Raul Mendiolea is the kind of Zelig of torture and corruption in Mexico. He's every single unpleasant act in Mexico, you'll find Raul Mendiolea in some way behind it. He's involved in drug trafficking he comes from Chihuahua. He's involved in drug trafficking in Juarez in the 40s, together with a woman called La Nacha. He's involved in the 68 student massacre as head of the police in DFE. And then in 76, he's made head of the judicial police, and he is basically, I think he, more than the DFS, imposes the kind of plaza system, the centralized plaza system on Mexico. And I think it's this break that is the one that robs the US of all faith in the judicial place. Because I think up to that moment, they have had faith, somewhat well-placed faith, that the national judicial police, the federal judicial police, is relatively uncorrupted, at least in this thing. And they will at least do what they ask. After Mendiolea comes to power, I think they have no faith at all. So I think that's the crucial breaking point, rather than perhaps the DFS, but which is similar. Yeah,
Carlos. No, I would agree with that.
Okay.
Oh, thank God for that.
Fabulous. Right, consensus. Yeah. Yeah. Other questions? One at the back over there.
Thanks. They've introduced myself. I'm Jonas. I'm Mexican. There are a few facts. I don't know if you can just comment about, like, the next years. Well, right now in a few months the elections are coming. Mm-hmm. The interference of the U.S. has been historically proved in different sectors of Latin America, including Mexico, and the drug trafficking has been linked with the fact that the weapons are coming in a big rate from the U.S. Another part from Europe, another part also from Great Britain. I don't know if you can comment a little bit of the political and economical and social aspects about what's going to happen or what could happen in a few months, from your historical point of view, having these facts that are highly important. According by example, just one very quickly, one Fast and Furious by example, just like they highly spotlight like the weapons that are coming that continue. We're having in three presidents' elections in three presidents' sections more than 300,000 deaths, which is one of the highest in the whole world. I know you just can comment a little bit about the logic of the cartels, economical and the political situation, which is going to come.
Thank you very much. So, how can the past predict the future?
I'm not sure if I can answer the question at all, but I will comment on the U.S.-Mexican relations, the current U.S.-Mexican relations in regard to drug policy, which is by no means my area. I have been trying to study the 20th century and not what is actually happening now. But I do believe that through history we're able to foresee the future and to understand the present. Obviously, this is why we are doing, or what at least, why I'm not a historian, by the way. I study political science, so I do try to understand history, like the present through the history. In any case, the U.S.-Mexican relation regarding drugs was from 2006 to 2012, in a very good momentum. They work hand in hand with the government of Calderón. I'm not sure if that's what happened during Peña Nieto. I have been talking with some people. I don't have any special contact now, But they have told me, or like the few people that I it happened that I know, have been stressing the that they are not cooperating at all with the U.S. at least in the federal level. So what I would expect, even if López Obrador would win the election, is that they will relaunch the cooperation in security matters, some kind of Operation Mérida, which was very much in the last 2 or 3 or 4 years. What do you think, Dudley? It's not true.
No, not true.
Tell me what's true.
For the first year and a half, there was almost no cooperation.
In the last 2 or 3 years, you mean?
No, for the first year and a half of the sexenio of Peña Nieto, there was very little cooperation.
Okay.
Very few meetings. They were meeting separately. They didn't have the joint meetings that they had. They met individually. And then the Mexican government changed its policy as the number of deaths began to rise and cooperation increased. And now there's a considerable amount of intelligence sharing plus cooperation on vetted units and other things like that.
Okay, to my excuse, I have to say that Dudley is by far the guy that knows most about about intelligence in Mexico. So you are the expert on that, obviously.
Ben, do you want to jump in?
I wanted to say something. I mean, I'm not going to predict it. I suppose it depends what piece of history you want to draw from. And we are in 1934. Is Pejer as a kind of Cárdenas revisited? Is he going to come to power? Or are we talking about 1940? So Meade as a kind of Avila Camacho conservative with the personality of a haddock, which is how they described Avila Camacho. Is that where we're at? Or is it just 2006 and they'll steal the election again? I no idea. I suppose the thing that I can say historically is this: the link between arms and the drug trade. This has a big historical basis. Something that I've been very interested in the 1970s is looking at the massive upsurge in murders in Sinaloa. It's always, I think, thought that drug trafficking brings death and destruction. Actually, it doesn't. Sinaloa is relatively safe. Has a very low, statistically low homicide rate from the 40s, 50s and 60s, despite being the centre of the drug trade. In the 1970s, there are conflicts between different drug organisations connected to different political groups, and they start to import vast quantities of guns. And as a result, I think, is you get a homicide rate of about 120 per 100,000, which is somewhere like the homicide rate in Juarez or Acapulco. So really
would
high
you say
homicide
that,
rate.
That it was because of the weapons or because
the
of
conflicts.
The introduction of cocaine?
I think that is important. I'm not
is
sure.
The key element.
I'm not sure to what extent. I think there is a shift away from the kind of locally based embedded traffickers. Pedro Avila has been the kind of classic example, who basically have contacts with the peasants who grow the marijuana, who grow the opium, to a kind of new generation that is much more interested in links to Latin America to South America and the cocaine traffic, and can do it from anywhere and don't need to be embedded in these communities. And so they can move to Guadalajara, and all they need is an airport and a certain sector of the government to be built off, and that's it.
Perhaps I'm going to using my position as chair, I might just ask a kind of similar question, kind of following on from the question at the back, which is, how does our understanding of the drug war as this much longer process, right, going back to the beginning of the 20th century or the moral panic of the 50s and 60s, how does that understanding affect our ability to grasp its causes and perhaps more importantly, kind of solutions to current contemporary problems. I guess, what are the lessons, perhaps, that we can learn? I think, Carlos, you hinted at this in terms of the criminalisation of addicts and how that had failed previously. But I'm wondering if there are broad kind of lessons from your respective kind of historical studies that can give us insight into the
maybe an anecdote. I have been reading a lot of FF newspapers also of the 60s, of the 70s, of the 80s. And a lot of discourses from the government telling us always the same experience, that a demand of illegal drugs in Mexico is growing every year. So we have, I have been able to gather 20 or 25 different, in different years, in different periods of history throughout the 20th century, reports of the government saying us that now it's important to act against drugs because the consume of the very different drugs is growing. They are saying exactly the same now. In 2018, they have been saying exactly the same discourse that now is time to act. So what I think would be great to have in Mexico is an institution or a lot of researchers doing really good research on drug consumption in Mexico to end with this lie about the fact that drug consumption is growing every year, even if that's true. And I think in some way in the last 5-10 years it is true, but this is by no means a problem or a core problem for understanding drug policy in Mexico. So this would be a lesson to be learned. And of course we cannot talk about changing drug policy without acknowledging the fact that drug users were criminalized, were in jail, were murdered, and there is a story that has to be written about the victims of drug policy in Mexico throughout the 20th century.
Okay. I'd say two very brief, somewhat flippant things. One, drug trafficking and drug producing is not inherently destabilizing or not inherently a violent act. Trafficking of guns tends to be. Mm-hmm. I suppose another thing, then actually following on from Carlos, is that, yeah, my best friend in Mexico City is weirdly works as the, he's head of drug rehab in Ciudad Neza. And every year I come to him and say, so where's this methamphetamine? Where's this, you know, terrible crack addiction that I hear is hitting Mexican barriers? And every time he goes, there's some kids smoking marijuana. That's about it. And this is in Ciudad Neza. This isn't some kind of Fresa community in Del Valle, no? So I kind of agree entirely with that. I mean, I assume if it's not hit Ciudad Neza, it probably hasn't hit other places in Mexico. But, yes, so the continual criminalization of drug trafficking, the fact that Mexican prisons are absolutely, I mean, they're filled to bursting, mostly with very low-level drug addicts, yes, similar to the United States. And that simply does not work. I mean, it works simply as a way to make most, you know, those people's lives incredibly, incredibly miserable. So those are the two, three easy lessons. I don't know.
Okay, we've got a few more. Okay, one at the back, and then I'll come to these two at the front. I'll collect them together. So, yeah.
Thank you. My name is Rafael Garcia. I'm a master's student at the LSE, and it came to my attention during your presentation that there's this adjective that it's attributed throughout the whole time to only one of the two actors involved in this war, that is corruption. So it's Mexico always the one who is corrupt. Mm-hmm. Like it was, for example, in the border, like if it was only Mexico running the border and not the U.S. running its own border. So I was wondering if during your research you ever found some sort of mention about corruption in the U.S. or related to U.S. government officials.
Okay, I'm actually going to collect some questions just so that we've got a bit more time. Can you bring the microphone to the front? Brilliant. We've got two here. And I'd like to invite some women as well to ask questions if there are any. Oh, wonderful. Okay, we'll come to you in a minute. Yeah.
Hi. First, just on the subject of crystal meth, I mean, it's not in NESA, but in drug-producing areas, the cartels are increasingly paying people for opium with crystal meth, and that's something that I've seen, which is, it doesn't bode well for the future. In terms of questions, two very interesting takes on a sort of international or transnational story. And I was wondering if there was some synthesis that could be made, because Ben, you didn't talk much, the several actors involved in your story, your cross-border story, the American federal government don't really factor in that analysis. It's about the two, you know, two regional stories across a border, and sort of vice versa. Carlos, it's about the two federal governments, but very little about the municipal actors, yes, or even state actors. I was wondering if you two had ideas about how the various different actors that you've mentioned in your separate analyses might work together, or how, you know, is there something that a story that comes together from both of these separate analyses that paints a wider picture about what's going on and why?
Okay, so one more question in this round, and then I'm going to come back to
testing my memory.
I came today not quite expecting what I was going to hear, and I'm totally amazed that this has been going on now for over a century, and it seems to be getting far worse, because the BBC reported about a month ago, I think, that the drug cartels have taken over in Mexico. And Acapulco has become a no-go area, and now Cancun is gradually becoming a no-go area, which a lot of British people visit. And then, for instance, that program, McMafia, with James Norton, were 8 episodes. It finished with him arranging for the Mexican drug growers to supply Europe via the Russian mafia. So it's quite... It sounds as if nothing's been done properly to bring this to a stop. So, and I just wondered what you thought they should do.
Oh, God.
Okay, so 3 sets of very simple, straightforward questions there for you both. I'll give you a few minutes to answer them.
I will concentrate my answer to Rafael's question, which is great. We always tend to talk about corruption in Mexico, not in the U.S. There is an explanation for that, at least for my case. Much of my research has been done in Washington, in federal archives of the U.S. In these archives, by reading these archives, you will see like a lot of mentions on corruption in Mexico, but obviously they don't talk about issues of corruption in the U.S. So there is this bias when doing the research, and as a researcher, obviously I have to know this, right? But that didn't come in my presentation, and you were right on that. However, the history of drug law enforcement in the U.S. is the history of corruption. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics was formed because the former institutions were destroyed by corruption at the state level, were very corrupted, and even there are many claims, and it depends if you talk with CIA agents or with DEA agents, but both claim that the DEA agents say that the CIA is very corrupted and that made some kind of business with Mexican traffickers. There is some evidence of that, of some kind of arrangements between the CIA and drug traffickers in Mexico. And when you talk with the CIA agents, they will tell you that also some DEA agents were in some way and participated in drug trafficking in Mexico. But this is also a history that should be written in the future if we have some evidence, if we have some archives. I am afraid I don't have it. You may know more about it than me. And only a few sentences on this also. These two different levels. I'm talking a lot about like federal issues. You are talking about local aspects of that. This is also a bias of mine. I haven't been, and I am not afraid of recognizing it, I haven't been in my life to a local archive in Mexico. So this is my aim, this is my objective as a researcher, admitting it, of course, and saying I should go to the local archive and see how this broad history is to be seen from another perspective. So it's a task. And it's very challenging, but I hope I will try to do.
There is much more.
It's much more to do, of course.
On the 3 issues, on the first issue of corruption, yes, I think there is corruption that is as endemic within U.S. customs, U.S. anti-drug forces. I mean, myself and Nat spent some of the summer interviewing DEA agents in around El Paso, Texas area, and pretty much one of the universal things is they all really distrusted other DEA agents, and they were all absolutely convinced that they were on the take. So we interviewed a guy called Phil Jordan, who's an extraordinary chap. He appears in a wonderful book called Down by the River, who is paranoid delusional in some ways. But, I mean, he was absolutely convinced that James Kirkendall, who's the guy who was in Guadalajara, who's head of the DEA in Guadalajara when Kiki Camarena was murdered, the DEA who was murdered in 1995, he was absolutely convinced that he was basically paid to keep his nose out until Kiki had been tortured to death. And he was absolutely convinced of him, whether it's true or not, but there certainly is an enormous amount of distrust. And you see it also in the archive, in the FBN archives. They don't normally go off to their own, they don't mention that, but they do mention corrupt customs officials, corrupt border police officers in some of the archives. In terms of the concept of corruption in Mexico, it becomes a narrative, but I think we kind of have to break down what we mean by corruption in many ways. Often this is just... Often what we call corruption is effectively kind of regulation on the cheap. So often state judicial police are not what we might class as police today, and maybe what the US would have classed as police, but probably what the US would have classed as police in the 1910s and the 1920s is that they effectively regulate the drug trade and the drug production and make sure it doesn't get out of hand and the competition between the different groups get out of hand. That's effectively what the police did in the United States in their big cities, really until the 1950s and the 1960s. And, I mean, there are books on the history of the police in the United States which argue, well, how did it get out of that? Well, they focused effectively on discriminating against certain ethnic and racial groups. So the only reason they weren't corrupt is they were too busy putting away African-Americans and Mexican-Americans. That brought them together, that brought white police officers together. So I think, you know, the corruption, the accusations of corruption are hugely problematic. It's something I think we have to
Before you
think
skip
about.
To the other topic, yeah. Only one sense on corruption that I was aware reading the archives. The U.S. law enforcement agency didn't have any problem in working with corrupted officials in Mexico as long as they were loyal. So loyalty was more important than corruption. So that was not a problem at all. Sorry.
Just one more. Yeah.
I wanted to quickly answer the latter person. I mean, it has got much worse. I would say, for those kind of afraid of going to Mexico, that I go to Mexico, I'm taking my family to Mexico in a month's time, and I wouldn't put my kids in danger or anything like that. It is not taken over, but there certainly are areas that used to be completely safe that have become fairly out of hand. Acapulco is a classic example. And they have drug trafficking has moved, and I think, suspect as you might be right, the drug market might have moved into places one might not have expected it to be. I mean, fundamentally, it's because of the complete fragmentation of the cartels into dozens of different warring groups. I mean, that's the fundamental cause of a lot of this violence, and also the movement of these groups into what they call polycrime organizations, what security analysts call polycrime organizations. They're not really interested in trafficking anymore. They're interested in extortion, kidnapping, gasoline stealing, robbery of trains, I noticed, was quite big at the moment. So that's one. That's about the third question. On how do they work together? It's interesting. While all this is happening, I missed out the paragraph, said Harry Anslinger repeatedly defends the Mexican government. All through the 1950s. So while these Californians are going, no, it's all the Mexicans' fault, he's saying, no, it's not. And I think he's saying, no, it's not, for two reasons. One, he's taught the Mexicans a lesson in 1948. And so this is kind of part of his... He says, look, we taught you a lesson, we kind of beat you up at the UN and said it was all your fault, and then now you're loyal and obedient to us, and now we're going to be loyal and obedient to you.
Corrupt but loyal?
Corrupt but loyal, but you're corrupt, right? Well, I mean, Anslinger himself was corrupt. Anslinger didn't go after every junkie in America. He went after particular junkies, mostly African American, right? Who did he send his people? He sent them after, was it the woman who wrote Strange Fruit? What's her name?
Lanacha?
No. Who's the singer of Strange Fruit? Yeah, Billie Holiday. He deliberately sends it after Billie Holiday. He doesn't send it after McCarthy, who is a morphine addict, right? He knows McCarthy is a morphine addict. He doesn't send any FBM people after him. But he does send it after kind of protesting African-American singer, So so A, it's that, and B, in American politics, he wants to control who he says are doing wrong. And during the 1950s, he says there are two people who are in importing drugs into the US. One, the communist Chinese, which is pretty much what the only thing the communist Chinese aren't doing at that time. And two, is Lucky Luciano, who again is out of the drug business by that time. I mean, he's flagrantly wrong about this. He kind of knows that it's the French, who are doing this through Turkey, but he can't say it because they are partners in a kind of Cold War mission. And ditto Mexico. He has got to support Mexico post 48 because they are Cold Warriors like America, and they're killing commies. So.
Okay, we thank you. We started 5 minutes late, so we've got time for another round of questions. So a question here, please, at the front, and one here as well.
Hi, my name's Anna Basolini. I think you've kind of alluded to this, so I don't want to go over things again. But essentially, Carlos mentioned as well that, to start with, corruption is generally seen universally as a hegemonically seen negative, I think, and when you argued that essentially the Mexican state participated in the emergence and development of the drug economy, you still very much focused on the fact that they had no hand in centrally regulating it. But in 2012, during the elections, Rizzo Garcia, who'd been working for the PRI during the 90s, essentially came out with this bombshell that the PRI was responsible for kind of controlling and regulating drug trafficking, and I think you mentioned the Plaza system as well, and essentially took responsibility for a level of social stability and a lack of violence that had then begun to explode later. And so on that note, I wanted to ask, to what degree the Mexican government can be seen to be involved in the drug trade, and by what extension to be held accountable for trafficking and levels of drug-related violence?
Okay, so just one more question, just because, and then we'll come back. Sorry.
Sorry. My name is Cindy, and I'm doing a Master in Social Policy and Development. I'll be playing a little bit like the devil's advocate in here, a little bit opposite to the question that we just heard. I come from Sinaloa as well, so I kind of know that, like, why some sort of things happened, not only because of the opportunity of the narcos to take advantage of, but also because of the lack of appearance of the state in different areas. So I would like to know your opinion about if the acceptance and at some point defense of the cartels is from regular people. It's because historically they've been filling in the gaps that the state is not filling as social providers. I don't know if you have some thoughts.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm really sorry for other people who don't want to ask questions, but I'm just going to
leave. We'll be around 10 minutes
after. There'll be a chance to ask questions to the speakers after we finish formally. So, Ben, do you want to go?
Just because I'm older and hence have a shorter memory. Do you mind if I do that first?
Right? Only because of the shorter memory right, arguments.
Okay, firstly, the Prius control. I think this is absolutely fascinating that they came out in 2012, because they're effectively saying they won the election basically by bringing a load of northern pan states back to the PRI. And their effective thing, they couldn't really, that chap did say in public, but most of them are pretty much saying, we controlled it for the last 20 years, so you will control it now. And they've completely failed to do that. I mean, they did clearly try to do that, but I just don't think they've managed it because it has become so fragmented and much more complex. I think they rather overstate it as well. I think there was probably tops a seven-year period from 78 where, I mean, they clearly assassinate this guy Pedro Aviles, so much so that a DEA agent sent me a picture of Pedro Aviles' head on a morgue slab. And said, we were told he was killed because he wouldn't become part of the Guadalajara cartel. And from about 78 to 85, I think there is some kind of control, some kind of plaza system. After that, I don't think there's a huge amount. I think there's an attempt by Salinas to kind of move things around, to try and make alliances with the Gulf cartel, but I don't think it's terribly successful. And you do see the violence increasing, partly to that reason. So, second thing, on the issue of corruption, I think here it's quite useful to use kind of subjective ideas of corruption. If anyone's interested in corruption in Mexico, there is an amazing essay by a guy called Alan Knight in a book by Eduardo Posada about basically subjective ideas of corruption in Mexico. And he makes the difference between, basically everyone deals with mordidas in Mexico. Mordidas are kind of basically making they're effectively a tax system, right? As a tiny two-bit police officer, you don't make very much money. I remember my my wife's uncle would come in every weekend with a massive helmet full of, he was a cop, traffic cop, full of cash. And he would just throw the money in the air and everyone would grab some notes and the kids would go out and buy food and then people down the road would go and buy kawamas of beer. And the beer kind of, and it was distributive corruption, right? I mean, not entirely acceptable, and it seems, it makes us feel kind of awkward and weird to deal with it. But it's, I mean, the guy was paid, you know, incredibly little money. So there is that form of corruption, which is broadly accepted. And then there is what in Africa is called grand corruption, which is effectively taking all the money of the state, taking all the tax money, saying you're going to build a road, and then go and build, I don't know, El Negro Durazo's version of the Parthenon, right? The famous DFA, Mexico City mayor, who builds an entire version of the Parthenon on the coast, and also a version of Studio 54. That's grand corruption. That's what people get annoyed about. Lastly, cartel as social bandit. I think this is absolutely fascinating. They clearly like to present themselves as it. And it's fascinating to see. Narco-culture, everyone kind of assumes that narco-culture begins from year dot, right, from the 20s or 30s. It doesn't. It kind of begins particularly in 1976. And in 1976, drug cartels are killing each other and they're doing very little social banditry. So they clearly create this image of the social bandit almost after the event as a kind of form of nostalgia, right? But also a form of propaganda, right? When is Jesus Malverde, the patron saint of drug set up? 1979, 1978? I mean, right at the time where drug people are kind of killing each other and looking for ways to prove they are the noble bandit, right? Pre then, I'm not sure I would call them social bandits, but there are some really interesting government agents who go down into Sinaloa in the 1940s and 1950s, and they go, no one is particularly rich here, but they've got radios. They've got more, I found out, more horses per capita than any other rural area of Mexico. They've got more cars by the 1960s than any other rural area of Mexico. The money is being distributed somewhat. I think after 1970, after the shift to cocaine, much, much less so. I think that's the key, the crucial shift, because you don't need peasants to transport cocaine in and out, basically.
Okay, Carlos, do you have any?
Yeah, only to conclude, maybe. I have some problems with the idea of an organization capable of organizing drug trade in a country like Mexico in the 1960s and 1970s. I have also problems with the idea of a party or a government or a macro state organizing drug trafficking, even if some expertistas tend to say that happened in the past. My impression, and I have been talking with some of them, is that they don't have really an idea of what was happening there. And they tend to reproduce a discourse or a narrative that tends to admit how great the PRI was and how strong the PRI was, but my impression is that didn't happen, even if they, these old people, are saying that. So I really don't believe with this narrative, but this is an hypothesis. And even for the purpose of conclude, again, it has to be written. It's a lot of research to be done. And this hypothesis and the other one should be clarified. And one obstacle for that is the fact that the federal archives are being classified. Yeah. We don't have in Mexico something like a police archive, a policía judicial archive. So we're unable to really trace what really happened. And I think the only way of doing that is going to the local archives, trying to gather many small histories, and through these histories and through many cases, try in the next years to construct a general framework of how really drug trafficking worked in Mexico throughout the 20th century.
You've heard it here. This is where the, you know, the future research lies. Lots of future research ideas for the audience here today. Thank you very much to our two speakers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much to you for coming.
Thank you to Jay.
And thank you
for
very much to Jay as well.
Yeah, thank you.
To organise things.
Yeah. Thank you very much.